cocaine.
Now, brothers and sisters, I'm troubled to say.
My blackbirds are bluebirds now.
FM Ann Arbor, the home of freeform, the discriminating listener's choice in the belly of the beast. And now, some more Ben Webster.
Good afternoon. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And today in the studio, Catherine Chalmers is here, sitting right across from me. And we're going to talk about conifer trees, bark beetles, and fire, which is it's a debut of this new work of yours, your latest project, and it's here at the Institute for the Humanities Gallery. And tomorrow, folks could have an opportunity to go and see you live at the Michigan Theater for your talk for Penny Stamps, the speaker series, An Artist's Journey into the Wild, which I love, because we're going to be talking, I think, a lot about conifer trees, bark beetles, and fire. But you're going to be talking tomorrow about spanning five of your large projects. And would that be covering the safari, like the cockroaches, the ants?
It covers all the live projects. So prior to these projects, I was a painter. I have an MFA in painting.
From London?
Yeah, yes. And this was switching from going to a paint store to a pet store was not a very easy slide.
Right, because was it going back to the time when you were creating the sculptures with dead flies with plants? Is that
I never did sculptures with dead flies. Yeah.
You didn't?
No.
I'm sorry, you would know your life. Nice how I'm like...
I mean, Damien Hirst did paintings of dead flies, but, you know, he's a lot about death. No, I raised live house flies.
Yes, and didn't you use their bodies for your work?
I was going to... The idea of raising them was I couldn't find enough dead ones. And so I was trying to make the act of painting to be more real, however nebulous that term was in my head. And so I thought, well, if I put real things into the paintings, elements from nature, sand, you know, leaves, twigs, ooh, flies, things that I could find around, then somehow it would be more real. This was part of the struggle of, you know, transitioning from one thing to another. So I found a catalog where I could buy housefly pupa. And so I bought a whole takeout container of them.
I mean, which figures into your photo book food chain that we'll talk about later.
And so I started raising them, and then I realized that the swarms of these little creatures flying in this terrarium, they were way more interesting alive than they were dead. So I thought, oh, well, before they die, I'll photograph them. And my next door neighbor in New York was a commercial photographer. He had been at everything in photography, a photojournalist. He was a White House correspondent. I mean, he was just, he had duplicates of all of his equipment, and he had equipment. I mean,
all the lenses.
He had everything. He had everything at different formats. And so
did he have darkroom space too?
So he had everything.
Produce, like, yeah. You could do it and then see it.
Well, he basically had everything. So I went to my neighbor. I said, "Hey, Joe, I want to photograph my house flies." He goes, "Really?" Because I had taken, you know, holiday snapshots, but that was about it. And there were many thousands of dollars that went in, that equipment cost in order to photograph these very small and fast moving creatures in an indoor space. You need high-end strobes because they have to have a lot of power that's delivered over a very short period of time. So that puts you into the higher echelons of what strobes are. And then, you know, you need a really good macro lens. And I didn't even know what film. Yeah, this is pre-digital. So a camera, I didn't even have a camera. So he lent me all the equipment and he essentially took me on, because I had never taken a photography course, as his student, which he, I think he had done with other people before. And I was his project. And so he taught me photography and lighting. And that's how I was able to have an idea. Oh, well, I think these would be more interesting to photograph live than use them dead in a painting. Mm. And I had never had such a barrier to an idea, to an acting out an idea. Because in painting, you have an idea, you go and you paint it. Or you do something in those mediums to sort of sketch it out or figure out if this idea
and
is worth
anything. Was your
material
always nature and like the natural world?
There was a lot of critters and creatures in my paintings, yes. And so, you know, the idea of photographing houseflies was not something I could do on my own. And I certainly wasn't going to go invest $20,000 in the equipment or rent it. I didn't even know what to, I wouldn't even know what to rent. So it was a stroke of incredible luck that he had the time and the patience to say, this is what an aperture is. This is what an f-stop is. This, you know, I didn't know anything.
And that he was your neighbor.
He was right there. Yeah. Yeah. So that was the first big hurdle. And when I started the Food Chain Project, I'd already had the camera. At that point, when he realized that I was going to do more photography, then he reached out to his photography people, and somebody was selling stuff in their studio, and he bought me a power pack and two light heads, and, you know, all used, or, you know, I bought it, but he figured out what it was. And so then he set me up. And so,
Could you even had a stage in your, well, yeah, maybe so, not a stage isn't the right word, but the white backdrop with the slope. So
yes.
That,
yeah. So he's kind of an infinity. So you could see what the animals were doing separate from the natural world, because I think what happens is when you see, let's say, insects tearing each other apart out there. Oh, well, that's just what insects do. But if you bring them out of that context and put them in a different context, you see them in a different way.
It's literally in a different light and in a proximity that...
Yeah. And I thought, you know, the idea of putting them in a neutral space, mm-hmm. I mean, although one can say that, you know, white space like that is a human space, but it was changing the context of how you looked at what they were doing.
Well, there's nothing to distract you from the actual outlines of the creature and their contours and their movement in the photos that you're capturing.
Yes.
Because it's so up close.
Yes. When the work got out the first time, which was at MoMA's PS1, I printed, I worked with somebody to print 45, 50 of the Food Chain series all around PS1. And but they, you know, they were printed from, I'm shooting 35 millimeter chrome. So there's really only so much that you could scale up, particularly since it was shot on white. White has a tendency to go all different colors, whether if you're in close or far back, it picks up density. And so that became a limiting factor, too, to when you're hanging these in a series, that the white all look like they're, you know, kind of the same white. And it was only when Mass MoCA wanted to show the project. And so I went up there and I visited, and the curator walked me into the room. And I'm like, wow, this is like as big as a basketball court. And she said, yeah, we want you to scale them up and put them everywhere. And I thought, amazing. So that's when kind of more of a rise of digital photography. So then all of the chromes were scanned, a high resolution drum scan. And then I worked with a retoucher, and we just basically, you know, kind of annihilated the whites. And so that then didn't become a factor. And once you are working digitally like that, you can dust it, you can, you know, you can play with the contrast and things like that. So they were 40 by 60, which meant that for the predators, let's say like the praying mantis and the frog, they were big enough to eat the human viewing it.
Yes, and so, when you were in the space, physically in the space.
Yeah, standing in front of it, if there was an insect that size, you better run for your life because they could easily eat you. So that's when the project was allowed to actually reach its denouement, in a sense. That is the size. And so, you know, there's a couple stages to all of that.
Well, I would say even the photo book, it does a job of bringing us closer to that experience. Not at all. Yeah. I can't imagine. It would be amazing to be in that life-size space with these images, Catherine. But when I was watching, because on your website, you've generously got the leaf cutters, so you can watch this whole film of yours online and watch it. And so I was able to watch it sort of in, you know, that screen, but not a big screen, although there's going to be an event that the Institute for Humanities, Amanda Krugliak and Ed Dimon are putting on next Tuesday, where folks can go to the State Theater and see the films on the big screen.
There's 9 short films, and they're going to show them all. And I have never seen them all shown together, so it should be really interesting.
Oh, that'll be so, and you'll be there too.
Yeah. And then I'll be in discussion with the director of the festival, Leslie, afterwards. So that should be fun.
And you won a prize at the Ann Arbor Film Festival as well for one of your films.
For the Leafcutters film.
Yeah, which will be one of the featured films.
Yes.
That are made up in 4 parts, is
yes.
it? Like the series?
Yes.
But to see it even on a screen by, and I was watching.
It changes everything. And also the
it's
sound.
It's so big because you're in. Oh, yeah, the sound. Let's talk about the soundscape.
Yeah, I mean,
because that's
never
what we heard at the top of the hour, and we'll be hearing for the breaks will be the soundscape that you created for the Leaf Cutters.
Yeah, well,
for We Rule. Sorry,
that's just one of them. But yeah, I mean, I like photography. I had never shot video before, so I didn't know one end of a camera from another. And
so another transition for you, Catherine.
Yeah, and so what I find is that I pursue my ideas or try to. You know, it's all vague and it's kind of exploring. And so I think, well, I kind of have this idea. This should be sort of interesting. But then I've got to figure out how to use those mediums because I'd never worked with sound and I had never worked with video. And so, you kind of start out slower and then your abilities become more, or your vision also, as well as your technical abilities. And then, you know, never mind all the editing and the software and stuff like that. But, you know, or how to light a set, well, because video lighting is very, very different than photography lighting. You know, so there's kind of a steep learning curve to figuring out these ideas. But by the time I started working with video, you know, Final Cut Pro was already out there. So it wasn't, you know, I could do things that, 10 years before you would need, you know, Avid. I would need to work with a whole, you know, group of filmmakers or whatever to somehow just envision this. But by the time I got to video, these things were possible. But I had a friend who was a filmmaker and he
like a Joe for this phase?
Yeah, although, but he... you know, I paid him, where Joe was just, you know, my neighbor doing it for fun. and he really, and he's technically really sound. So he helped me just get on board. And so I started out, I mean, the first video was one of the cockroach execution videos. And it's funny because, you know, somehow, I mean, we go to movies and we see carnage, you know, how many bodies are in an action film? You know, just endless. Right. But nobody ever goes to the director and said, you know, look at all these bodies you're killing. How could you do this? You're terrible. And but as an artist, and I don't know why people would think this, somehow, like, you're supposed to tell the truth. Like, artists live in this amalgam between fiction and nonfiction. You know, it's not like filmmakers can say, you know, any untruths that they want in terms of these battles that are on, you know, these movies. You know, I essentially, you know, burned a cockroach at the stake. I didn't burn it. You know, the live one at the beginning is not the one that burned. You know, I probably used 10 different dead roaches and only one live one that I just blew on, and it went like this and got all scared. And, you know, then I cut. I'm using all the techniques that filmmakers use to make you believe something. And I mean, it was endless hate mail. People screaming, running out of a theater. You know, how could you do this? Why would you? And I'm like, you know, New York City spends millions of dollars on, you know, exterminating cockroaches. I didn't do anything.
And you're
hating me. Like, I mean, this is the whole sort of point, is that, you know, it's bringing up this way that we interact. Let's say I'm interested in the larger picture of our negative relationship to the natural world. And it's been interesting showing it in different places because, you know, in California, I mean, it was just the worst. But I did a cockroach show in Boise, Idaho, and there was a disclaimer by the three execution films, and it says no cockroaches were harmed in the making of this work, which is true. I mean, I was raising cockroaches. You know, at the end of their life, they die, and then I would put them in rubbing alcohol and pickle them and use them for other art pieces. And
all cockroach humane.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not killing them. I am feeding some to my frogs. But I'm standing there and he goes, are you kidding me? Why would you put a sign like that? You would need to be killing as many as you can. And I thought, well, that's the difference between locations. I mean,
Idaho. Is that why one of your studios where you work is in Idaho, too?
It's not why.
Oh, it's not why. Yeah. Okay. You're like my people.
No. Yeah, no. But, you know, they're hunters and they're fishermen and they're ranchers and they're farmers and, you know, they raise things and they kill things and they hunt things. And, you know, cockroaches are not indigenous to the American cockroach is not indigenous to the United States. It lives in urban areas. And, you know, I'm not making an argument for their preservation. And I'm not making an argument for their destruction. I'm just interested in this animal that is the kind of center point of everybody's hate. Like, if there's one part of nature you're okay, you're allowed, you know, to hate, you know, cockroaches, mosquitoes, you know, I mean, there aren't that many beyond there.
And
you know?
Even houseflies, like, in a way, because they can be so annoying. And yet you're saying they have, like, a social life. They are caring for each other or...
Well,
or
I don't... I mean, I wouldn't say they're... caring for each other. I mean, they're having a lot of sex. I mean, but
right. That's one way of caring.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah. But you know, it's a complicated world out there. But you know, houseflies. I think one of the reasons houseflies carry a lot more pathogens than cockroaches do, and so do mice. But mice are mammals, so we like them better. And flies fly. You know, we can't fly. I mean, that's kind of a great trait, you know, and they fly around. And so, you know, they are not the point. Like, I couldn't have used a fly or a mouse to be the focal point of a project investigating our adversarial relationship with nature. Cockroach, nobody cared.
Yeah, except a few folks in California. No, just
kidding. Yeah, I know, it's true.
Well, because on your website, there is the picture of the cockroaches that are hanging.
Yeah.
And I
they're all dead.
They yes. And it's, but what you create with that visual is in a great way super unsettling to see them hanging there.
Yeah, I kind of you know, did the mock executions in the ways and the means that we have devised to execute each other.
Exactly.
And you know, I was very clear that this isn't about what humans have done to other humans, but what humans are doing to the non-human world. And then using
it as
a metaphor for our relationship to the natural world, and not making a comment on the sufferings that humans have endured at the hands of humans. So, right. You know, it's there's multiple hangings. You know, there was a drowning, there's electric chair, which I used to test the coil. That was interesting. And then, you know, so, and then burning at the stake. So there were many different types of hangings different types of deaths. But what we tend to do, a gas chamber, because what we tend to do is, you know, we basically poison them or gas them. It's just the way we do it.
Because you bomb a house.
Yeah.
And
I was sort of interested in, I mean, the amount of pesticides we use in this world is just daunting. So, you know, it's just annihilation on a mass scale. But if you take one individual insect and you highlight its death, we respond completely differently. And that's sort of what I was playing with.
So, so good. And when you're conceptualizing these ideas, like how do you know that's what you're playing with? Or when do you start thinking, oh, this is what I'm getting to? Or is it pretty early in the process? And that's why you're saying, and then I have to figure out these ways to enact it or to.
Yeah, there's the production part of it. I mean, really, I think it's these vague ideas that then you start making work and it reveals itself as you go along. But as you go along, then you get other ideas that wouldn't have happened had you not made this first foray. And so I stay with a project until the ideas no longer come. Like I feel that I have reached the place where this area of inquiry has gone as far as it's going to go for me. And then there's another project. But it takes a long time. Sometimes it takes a long time. Like with the Leafcutter Ant project, I shot the first film. I couldn't figure out where we would go from there. You know, so it's not really.
Because that was in South America, right?
That was in Panama.
Okay, it was Central. Okay.
Yeah, and it was. And that project was based on a lot of luck. Mm-hmm. The first, I got invited down by a billionaire art collector who had a private island in Panama.
Whoa.
And 30 miles of coast. And he had a science research lab on the island. And he said, I'm sick of scientists. I want to get artists to come down here. Do you want to come down? And I said, do you have any leafcutter ants? And he goes, oh, yeah, they're everywhere. I said, okay, I'm coming.
So at that point, you already knew you wanted the leafcutter ant?
Or oh, I'd been dreaming about doing this project for 8 years.
No!
Yeah. It took that long to sort of... And then I got the opportunity. Well, I'd never gone on an expedition. I didn't have anything to work in the field. Everything I had done, you could always plug in. And you can't plug in the rainforest. So there was this sort of mad scramble. And he invited me, I think, like in November. And I think it was by February I was down there. So it was a very short turnaround. And I learned a lot. And the fact that I shot one film in just that one trip was really kind of a miracle, because most of the other films have taken two times down there. And then I did that. But I didn't know where it was going to go after that. And if it wasn't for having the good luck of meeting somebody who had a place on the Osa Peninsula in Costa Rica, right outside the Corcovado National Park. But he owned like 5,000 acres. So, I mean, it's just forest. And he went all the way down to the water. And I went down there and understood that the configuration of plants there supported more large colonies in a small area than I'd ever seen anywhere. In other words, I saw the different behaviors between colonies.
Right.
And it was that dynamic of having essentially like this Game of Thrones with all these empires that allowed the project to go farther. Because on his island, he only had two large colonies. One of them was really hard for me to reach. And, you know, the colonies behave differently. And so what I found is that that colony kind of, I felt like I could do with it what I did. But it was only when I got to Costa Rica and had like six huge colonies to work with. Some of them, you know, were really stubborn, wouldn't take anything that they weren't specifically harvesting themselves. Even if I got a branch from the same tree and moved it right on their pathway.
You had touched it.
No.
So they didn't want it?
No, nothing to do with that.
No.
They just, you know, there was just like really inflexible. And then other colonies, I mean, I have my speculations about why some colonies maybe were more flexible than others. Other colonies, you know, I'm introducing flowers that I've gotten away from, you know, in the jungle. I'm walking around getting flowers.
Letters that you've cut.
Well, the letters were from leaves that they were harvesting. So, but the flowers, you know, some colonies are like, thank you very much. This is great, you know, and other ones were more tepid, you know, so they would take half and also continue their own. So I had a mixture. And then that's when I found an ant war too. So that opened up a whole. So, you know, having the good luck to meet this person who had that just opened the project up because I couldn't figure out where it was going to go from there.
And so that allowed you to make the series of four.
Yes.
That became the Leaf Cutters.
Yeah, and I couldn't have done four from his island.
So you had this idea before you were invited to the island, like 8 years prior. And then how many years would you say were you in like the process of making and then Costa Rica added
10 years.
To the... So 10 more years.
Yeah. Yeah. I shot the first film at the beginning of 2007, but then I took time out to do a couple of cockroach shows.
Why not?
Yeah, why not? and then it was pretty much the film was finally the film with the four chapters was finally done in 2017. So it took that long. But you know, I'm down there for 6 weeks, and then I'm. Come back, and then I, you know, 1 year later, go back down for six more weeks. So, you know,
right.
It's not like I could work with them whenever I wanted.
And you're also working on parts of the film when you're in your
well,
studios.
I'm editing.
While
yeah.
you're editing.
And plotting out what worked and what didn't work and how to go forward.
How did you do the soundscapes? Can we talk about the sound? Because there's, in your films, I love, there's no narration. There's no voiceovers.
Yeah.
It's the sound of where you are. Now we know Panama, Costa Rica.
Well, the first four films of the Cockroach Project, the guy who was helping me with filmmaking and editing and everything, we did the sound ourselves. But you know, it was fairly simple. And then when I did Safari and raised those 20 different species, it took 2 years. And so when I finally started, you know, got a good edit and needed sound, he said, we can't do this. You need to get somebody who can do sound for you. So he recommended somebody who was a musician, was trying to get into sound. And it took him 3 months to do the sound for the 7-minute film. And, you know, you can get cricket sounds on the internet. There's sound libraries where you can get thunder and things like that. But, you know, what does a millipede sound walking in the grass sound like? So he was doing all the Foley work and trying to, you know, create what those sounds were.
So Foley work, meaning it's not actually getting a mic up to the caterpillar's legs.
No.
You're creating what it would sound like.
Yeah. Or the sound of a snake going through the grass. Or the sound of a poison dart frogs, you know, jumping. And one of the best ones. So there's these two rhino beetles and they're fighting. That was his kids' plastic horses going together. And then for when the praying mantis is eating the fly, that was his wife eating a nectarine.
That must have held a special place in their hearts.
Yeah. So all of that was specifically created because I'm shooting in the studio and there's really only me swearing that things aren't working. You know, I'm not recording sound.
That could be the outtakes.
Yeah. But once you get into the rainforest is a rich, rich, rich tapestry of sound. So all of those sounds were recorded there. And the
fullness of the sound is what you're getting when you're hitting record and you're
No. It's all put together after.
How so?
Well, because when I'm filming, you're going to hear me. So
right.
I'm not recording
crackling
sound.
Around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the sound is all recorded separately, and then you put the tracks together. So, you know, the ants talk to each other, so they're recorded. Then you have the cicadas, you have the crickets, you have all the insect sounds, you have the birds, you have the nightjars, you have the howler monkeys. You know, you have all of these different layers of sound, and it's such a rich soundscape that you can tell the time of day by the sounds the animals are making. And the cicadas come in at a certain time. The first is the birds early in the morning, right before it really kind of gets a little bit light. And then you have the howler monkeys. And then the cicadas sort of kick in maybe about 7. You know, in the tropics, the sun comes up at 6 and down at 6. So there's really no dawn or dusk. You know, it's up or it's down. And so then, you know, then during the middle of the day, it quiets down a little bit. But you have... you know, you have the macaws. So there's a lot of really interesting sounds. And because the ants do make sound, but we don't see them as making sound, yes, I can put, you know, the track of ant sounds in there, but that doesn't really accentuate what they're doing. So I had the other animals in the forest essentially accentuate what they're doing. So at the end scene, when they're walking along carrying their letters and spelling out "We Rule," I thought, well, the howler monkeys are going to cheer for them, right? You know? So I was using the sounds of the forest to accentuate the movements of what the ants were doing.
This is a beautiful thing. Let's hear some of it. Let's take a break and let's hear the soundscape from Leaf Cutters. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. If you just tune in, you're just in time. Today on the program, Catherine Chalmers is here with her latest project, the exhibit Conifer Trees, Bark Beetles, and Fire, now in the gallery at the Institute for the Humanities. Catherine, so that was a soundscape. Before we get too far away from that, was that, I think I'm trying to remember from the film, the last sounds we heard, was that like sort of the giant cricket that was in the frame for part of it? Or did you hear, like, after watching your films, it's a different experience than if I had just listened to the soundscape alone without the visual medium part.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know which part sound you're referring to.
Okay.
I mean, it was the howler monkeys at the end. There's some agoutis in there. There's really everything in there that makes noise.
Was there anything like a cricket actually moving where it would sound kind of like something, like a leaf or something crackling like that, as if not like footsteps, but something like the movement? And
I mean, there was no single insects that were recorded.
Like, it's or highlight.
Yeah,
like, oh, okay.
I mean, there's just so many insects down there. It's just a wall of sound.
Yeah, yeah. I do. But thank you so much for telling us about like the beetles that had the fight with the crashing plastic horses. Like all of this is so. But that was a separate project. This was actually the full, like, all the sounds that were present when you were down in Costa Rica or in Panama.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
no Foley added at all, just like the sounds that you've
Yeah, some of it things were amplified or slowed down or, it's not like that there wasn't manipulation. There's always some manipulation and not so much with...
to create the experience.
Yeah. I mean, right. WeRule was... I mean, I'm not a documentarian or a scientist, and so I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, you started out as an engineer.
Yeah.
Then you went to art school for painting, and now you are you.
Now I don't know what I am. But, you know, I think, you know, I think... You know, the general idea with WeRule, the first film, was to have the sounds of the forest, background sounds, and then have the different animals highlight things that the leafcutter ants are doing. Have it to be realistic enough. But the whole thing is kind of, it's kind of realism. And I think that's where the kind of the fun comes in, because it opens as if you're seeing a nature documentary. And then all of a sudden you start seeing these letters, and then they end up spelling out WeRule, you know? So, you know, it kind of leads you on to something where, like the cockroach film, it's swimming out of the primordial sea, you know, it's fake from the very beginning. And so, you know, I'm always playing kind of with that. But the second film that I did was leafcutter ants go across the forest floor and carrying bits of the high canopy. So you have this brown forest floor, and they are carrying in their mandibles, you know, bright green leaves and, you know, bits and pieces of flowers. And they're parading for 100 meters across the forest floor. So it's this really beautiful sort of flickering live line drawing, and it looks like a parade. So I thought, well, that's interesting. Let's push this and have it be a pageant, you know, a celebration. And so I thought, you know, I as a painter, I was very much a colorist. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to have them carry color. So that's when, you know, I got my snake boots on and just went around and collected as much flowers as I could, and which I pretty much had to do before every shoot because, you know, everything degrades as soon as you pick it. So... and then that's when I was testing different colonies to see who would, you know, carry the flowers. And so then I was essentially, you know, running the ants over, and I'm always trying to get them off the ground because they're brown, the dirt's brown, leaf litter's brown. So, you know, I'm trying to make them more special and get them up. And then I actually can look into them too, as opposed to down at them.
So important for the perspective that you're giving.
Yeah. Trying to be more on their level. So, and that's all fine. So I had the same kind of strategy for doing sound because you're in the forest. But then what do they do with these flowers? Well, what happens with a pageant and a parade? And, you know, I was thinking like, you know, like a Balinese festival or a pagan rite, you know, well, they're going to bring their special offerings and lay them at the feet of a golden idol. I mean, isn't that what we do? And, you know, I was thinking of all of our rituals and, you know, oftentimes they include a sculptural version of a human, you know, whether it's Jesus or Buddha or, you know, whatever. I mean, there's like this body, oftentimes men, that, you know, is kind of the focal point of these rituals. And so I thought, oh, well, you know, they're going to worship a golden idol, you know, kind of like what we would. And so I happened to find like the one jeweler in New York who was willing to work on this with me, and we made an 18 karat gold ant. And the thing is that, you know, I'm with a macro lens, so, you know, it has to be good. It can't be. So I built sets as if the ants were taking these special offerings and going down into their underground colony and then laying these flowers at the feet of their golden idol. Well, what happens when you leave the forest and go down into a tunnel? Well, you lose the sounds of the forest. So then what do you do with the sound? And that's became
What did you do then?
Then you are sort of thinking, what would an ant worship ceremony sound like? You know? You know, so you can't, you know, you don't want the sound to make the whole thing look fake. It has to be according to what the expectation, even though nobody has an expectation like this, including me, of what that might sound like.
But you also, when you hear or see something, if it's not right, which is what I think you're talking about, you understand that you might have some kind of expectation that wasn't met. even if you aren't able to articulate beforehand.
When you're in the forest, it's easy because the forest is just, you know, it's just so much sound. But once you go down underground, that's when the first challenge really came up, because what would that sound like? And that's where the Himalayan bells came in. And there's like footsteps, you know, from a cathedral, you know, like as walking in a cathedral. So there's all these layers. And then also the ant sounds, they stayed in there. So that I wanted it to be like this, you know, pagan rite. Right. And so I wanted the sounds to sort of have that otherworldly quality without being cheesy otherworldly, because you're an ant colony. So that was, the last three films, We World essentially was an easy one, but the last three became really difficult because each of them went out of the forest in one way or another. So then what happens?
And you wanted that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I filmed it.
That was what you were finding.
Yeah. Well, no, it's what I was creating.
That's what you were creating. Exactly. Yes.
I became a good ant wrangler.
One of many qualities on your CV, I'm sure. That must be one of the best ones. Oh, you know, let's talk about your event here, the ones that are coming here in Ann Arbor, just because it's going to be an incredible week with you, and you've already been here for Conifer Trees, Bark Beetles, and Fire. Mm-hmm. You were here last week, and you were starting. You were painting. You were installing the exhibit.
Painting two murals.
Can you talk about that? Let me do the events, because otherwise, knowing me, I'll talk us right up to the last moment. An exciting thing tomorrow will be the Penny Stamp Speaker Series, An Artist's Journey into the Wild. You all are getting a sense of this artist's journey and how wild it can get from today, I hope. And this will be Thursday, September 11th, 5:30 at the Michigan Theater. Then right afterwards, there's the opening reception with Catherine Chalmers. And this is over at the Institute for the Humanities on Thayer, 6:30 to 8 p.m. You can come. You can see these murals we're going to be talking about. And the art that you created, that we'll also be talking about now. Talking about golden idols, I feel like we have a bark beetle golden idol in this show too. So there's like a thread. And then on Friday, September 12th at 3:00, again at the Institute for the Humanities. You're very busy, Catherine. Well done, Amanda and Ed, for giving the schedule. Complex Communities, A Conversation on the Imperiled Forest Ecosystems of the Western United States. And that will be you talking with Dr. Stella Cousins and moderating by our very own Amanda Krugliak. And then next week, it's the films we've been talking about, A Night of Insect Encounters, films by Catherine Chalmers at the State Theater. This is very exciting. Okay, so Catherine, how was it to arrive in Ann Arbor and hit the ground and begin making this work that had been in, you've been working on for years with the conifers,
I had been thinking about the project for years, but I hadn't figured out how to do the project, because it's not centered around an insect. It's centered around an ecosystem. And in fact, I've never seen the bark beetle. And so what is the mediums? Well, it wasn't going to be film. I'm not filming. There's no beetles to film. I mean, they're all underneath the bark, and unlike the ants, they are not charismatic, I don't think. When Amanda very bravely asked me, you know, agreed, I should say, to do the show, because she thought maybe we would do an ant show. And I said, but you know, I'm kind of cooking up this other work. And I think I can get a show together by then. And so it's all very new. And
so exciting.
Yeah, really exciting for me. And then she said, well, you know, I had done a mural with the ant show in New York. And I said, she goes, you want to do a mural here? And I'm like, yeah, okay, great. But anyways. And then she said, you do want to do another one? So I thought, okay. So I, I've been testing them out and materials and what I'm going to do. I'm testing it out on 2 feet by 2 feet. I'm not really sure what it's going to look like or how much of the materials I need. So, you know, when I came here, there was a lot of big questions. One, what would it look like at 26 feet as opposed to 2 feet? Mm-hmm. And would the materials behave on a vertical surface as they do on, let's say, watercolor paper? So, we gave ourselves lots of time, and it turns out I just like breezed through them, and I'm like, oh wow, okay, this worked.
That must have been so. How did
that
it
was a
feel
relief.
When
that
you
was
were
a relief.
Up there on the ladder? And yeah, how did?
I mean, it didn't take very long for me to realize that it was going to work on the ladder. Yeah.
And was it because, could you describe them for us a little bit? Because when you enter in through the main doors of the Institute for Humanities into the building, you walk into like the big open sort of apse area or so. And on your left, you see an open door that you can go into for the exhibit. But that's where you first see, you encounter the first mural.
Yeah, it's 11-foot high rendering of a burnt tree. And the burnt tree, I've been hiking in the forest for years and taking pictures with my iPhone before I got a camera and actually was shooting for the work in the show. But I have decades of images, and I was out actually backcountry skiing in the burn area, and there's just this really beautiful burnt sort of tree from a mega fire that happened in 2013, and I had taken a photo of it. And I like it just because it's leaning. And by this point, it's really degraded. You know, it's not this really beautiful big conifer. It's just sort of these stubby sort of limbs. And so I thought, oh, well, that would be a good tree to put there on the wall text. And when I'm out there photographing the mega burns that have happened around where I am, I collect chunks of the burnt tree.
And this is in Idaho.
Yeah, this is in the Sawtooth National Forest. And that's just where I've been going since I was a kid. So, you know, and even though it's been happening in the Sierra Nevadas and I've been there too, I have recently spent more time in the Rockies. And so, you know, I take chunks of charcoal and I would bang them up with my hammer. And then I was hand grinding it, but then I found I couldn't do that at scale, so I bought a kind of an upscale coffee grinder. So I'd pound it first, and then I'd put it in the coffee grinder, and then mix it with gum arabic and water. And so it essentially became kind of a chunky painting medium. And that's what I was using for the fire watercolors. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I could do this at scale and actually do it on a wall. But, you know, paint behaves very differently than absorbent watercolor paper. But nevertheless, it worked. And so I painted the burnt tree that I had seen years before when I was backcountry skiing. And anyway, so that's that tree. And then I've been collecting images and also branches of the bark beetle's destructive patterns. And obviously the big trunks, you know, of the tree where I'm photographing, where, you know, the bark has fallen off, the tree is dead, and you see all these incredible patterns. And anyway, I have a whole archive of photographs of those patterns. But the smaller branches are where the secondary bark beetles are. And they're not egg galleries. They're just wanderings of, you know, the larva, the beetle. So they're abstract. And to me, they're endlessly interesting because, you know, it kind of looks like a Bryce Marden painting, but then it looks like hieroglyphics and it kind of looks like larval language. And it just takes on all these possibilities because it's off form. There is no form. It's free form. And so the mural was, you know, maybe 4 inches by 1.5 inches, the pattern on a branch. And then I blew it up 50 times, and that's what's on the wall. And it's painted red, because red is the color of death in a conifer. So when you see a tree that's been killed by a bark beetle, the green needles turn red from the top down. And so it's very specific, this red, and that's why the red keeps repeating in the project.
Mm. And then you have the red in the watercolor.
Yeah, and that's why I'm using just red as opposed to yellow and orange, because if you look at a flame, which is what I was doing when I first started these, you know, it's kind of more yellowish and orangish than it is really red. And And so that's the colors that I was using. And I kind of hated it. Mm. And it took a while to realize it's the red that's important. And also it's sort of, you know, it has a relationship to blood, to the body. And so once I took those out, then everything started to be much better for me.
It makes the paintings, because so we've shifted from the second mural that folks could find in another, there's two rooms which your exhibit is in. And it's interesting that there's a table and chairs in the room.
And it happened to be red.
And they're red too.
I'm like, wow, I guess I'm one of those painters who matches the couch. Which I don't know.
It was startling to walk in. I loved it to see it that way as well. Yeah. But when you walk into the main exhibit, which we'll call it, like, because
it's the gallery show.
It's the gallery show. Yeah. Thank you. You'll see these watercolors, this like the series of four of the watercolors that you chose to include, and they are the red and the black and the watercolor, but with that the charcoal that you've mixed
the chunky ground up tree. And what happens is, see, gum arabic is soluble by water, so I spent all this time recreating an image that I've taken from when I was hiking in the burn areas, you know, the tangle of trees. And I don't like making it up. I like kind of basing it on things that I've seen out there.
It definitely feels like you're standing to look up at least two of these, I would say.
Yeah, well, there are kind of in a grid of four.
Yeah.
But I spent a lot of time repainting this scene, which is just the charcoal on white paper. And then I kind of douse it with water and fire-colored watercolors, and it lifts off the charcoal. And that's where it gets all smoky, as if the fire is restarted. So it kind of reignites the blaze. But the whole thing is chaos, and it has to be chaos because fire is chaos. And so I'm taking something that I have put a lot of time into. It has value for me from all that time, and I'm destroying it. Which is kind of what happens with the fire itself, is it destroying the landscape. So I lose a lot of them because either they get completely out of control and they just become a mess, or maybe I didn't go far enough. And, you know, they're kind of tricky because it needs to show the chaos of it all without actually losing some sense of, I don't know, aesthetic in a way.
Well, because it's like with this, because it's a still picture that's capturing this motion and movement, you need to be having that moment that's captured, right? Even though the fire would, like maybe some of the other pictures are showing after more destruction has happened, but you're able to get that moment.
Yeah, well, it feels
textured. Texture.
There's a lot
too.
Of texture. Yeah. And that's the difference, I think, between, you know, I'm collecting these materials from the forest. So, you know, could I go to an art store and take vine charcoal and ground it up? I don't know, maybe. But you're not going to get the interesting textures that come out of actually trees. And the thing about a forest fire, even the ones that are really high intensity destructive fires, they don't burn all the way through. You know, so there's only the kind of the, you know, 2 inches, let's say, on the outside, and then you're starting to get wood. So if you hike into the aftermath of a mega fire, you know, like the 2013 Beaver Creek fire, you're not seeing many black trees. All the black has fallen off. And then you end up seeing kind of like skeletons and really old fires, like the 1988 Yellowstone fire where I was, they're white. It's like bones.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, it changes over time. And that this summer there was...
The death is there.
The death is there, but it changes the look of it. And I was really keen this summer to go into two big fires that happened nearby.
So recent.
Yeah, recent fire. And the, you know, the ground is black. You know, like nothing has grown back.
Yeah.
And that's a very different, it's a very different experience than going to one that was essentially 12 years old with the Beaver Creek fire.
Yeah. The history of the,
yeah,
the fires.
Yeah, see it
the
change.
Death.
Yeah.
So the beetles, the bark beetles, because they are then on the facing wall from the watercolor, the red and the charcoal, the trees. How did you decide to use the resin from the trees to create also another textured quality? Because In these pieces, there's five.
Six.
That trace the life cycle of the beetle. Some of them we get to see your watercolor, your pencil drawing with watercolor, I believe. And then we get to see resin ones.
No, there's no watercolor there.
There isn't?
Okay. Oh, no. It's just resin.
Oh, so the yellow that we see with the...
Oh, that's resin.
That's resin.
Yeah.
What about the stuff that the stuff, sorry, my technical terms, but like that makes it more two-dimensional instead?
Well, that's me layering the resin.
So that's just layers and layers of resin.
I do a pencil drawing to set where it is and what it's going to look like, and then I paint it with the resin. And then I just paint layers over it to make the darks.
And was it more layers the older it got? Was that the methodology of how you chose to...
Well, no, it's the shading around a bug. I mean, you know, if you're gonna do something that's kind of three dimensional or looking three dimensional, you want it to be, you know, kind of darker and lighter and get the shading. And so I would just, you know, paint more resin on top and just layer it to get it darker and darker.
When did you decide that was going to be? Because you're thinking about the concepts are the interconnectedness of the conifer trees, these particular bark beetles that are killing trees, as well as fires that are killing trees, right, in the ecosystem.
Well, the resin is the tree's resilience to disease and infestation. So the trees that are suffering from stress of climate change have a difficult time producing enough resin to have a response against disease and also the infestation of the bark beetles. So it's the linchpin. And also,
and their numbers are on the uptick, the bark beetles.
Yeah. So because all the trees are under stress, or so many of them are now, that they can take more trees. Because bark beetles really can't take down a healthy tree unless it is under stress from other reasons. And usually that's a buildup of density of trees, not enough water, and too much heat.
So your work, your art, and the stories you're telling is really interconnected with the story of climate change and what humans are doing.
I'm focusing on a changing dynamic in a forest ecosystem. And there's lots of factors that go into it's not doing as well as you know, air pollution. And this is one thing that Dr. Stella Cousins will talk about is, you know, all the different factors that are, you know, reducing the resilience of the forest. It's not just climate change. It's been, you know, there's clear-cut logging, which makes a difference. There's 100 years of fire suppression, having this idea that you need to suppress fires because they're bad, not understanding that actually they're part of the forest ecosystem. So there's a lot of, you know, awareness of the wrongs that we did before, but we're also adding on stressors now of too much heat and not enough water.
Yeah, because the beetles were part of the system that was successful before too.
They're indigenous to the forest. They're not invasive.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your work and like bringing these ideas visually, these experiences. Yeah, everyone, you can go and see Catherine Chalmers tomorrow at the Penny Stamp Speaker Series and the reception at the Institute for the Humanities afterwards, and get yourself to the exhibit to see the gallery and the two murals. Thanks so much for being here today, Catherine. Today on Living Writers, Catherine Chalmers. And there's two more walls we didn't even get to talk about yet. So
that's
you have
right.
to go to see it, everyone. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks for listening today. Thanks to Amanda and Ed for being studio audience, Jason for engineering. And hi, Mom. Thanks for listening out there, and all you listening out there, too. Until next time.
Thank you.
Totally. I mean, I guess it's week two, but we could talk about Arch's struggles versus OSU.
What's up?
Is better or worse?
Here's the report from the world of sports on WCPN.
Live from Ann Arbor, welcome back to the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar, joined by a panel of Paul, who's making his third DSR appearance ever, third in 3 days, and Reynold, who's new to the show. Welcome aboard, guys. How are we doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Solid. How are you?
Doing well. Doing well.
Yeah. And so we'll just get things, started with just our quick icebreaker. Since the weather's nice, we'll go with something topical. Favorite ice cream flavor?
Ooh, I'm a big mint chocolate chip guy.
That's a great shout.
Yeah.
I also love, so I love the Thin Mints, and I recently discovered that there are Thin Mint flavored Pop-Tarts.
Mm. Ooh.
So now I have those in my apartment, and those are probably going to be responsible for some unhealthy eating habits, but I tried one yesterday. They were very good, so.
Sounds good. Sounds interesting.
They're great. They're great.
Yeah, probably gonna have to go like chocolate chip cookie dough, that Ben & Jerry's flavor, summer hit. So
yeah, that's fantastic. Another shout. I just love a good chocolate fudge brownie, you know.